problem for today is dealing with raising children, and I might add husbands, wives, and singles, for abundant living through play, games, sport, and athletics, without compulsive competition. And I like to think in terms of competition, by the way, of cooperative competition, which may sound like a dichotomy or opposite, but in fact, to be competitive, there has to be an amount of cooperation. And so the purpose in sport and athletics ought to be to make it as cooperative as possible while you are having keen competition. And I like to talk about keen competition as opposed to kill, to beat. And the concept of to win against oneself or within a cooperative environment is quite different than talking about to beat or to win because you have beaten someone. And I think it's a concept in our society that has been a difficult one for us to deal with. And it's been difficult because we live in a society of what they call Jacob's ladder, which is we are always climbing one upon the other in order to reach our highest goal. And that it's almost essential, for example, in parts of the business world, in parts of the sports world, that instead of moving together in our actions, we tend to move in the horizontal, upward or vertical, rather than a horizontal kind of plane. Now, this doesn't mean that I am not striving in a competitive sort of way for an achievement. But it's the reason for the achievement that sometimes is the answer to what is happening and what ought we to be doing in the play world. Unfortunately, or fortunately, sport is nothing more than a little society. We do not set the pace for society, unfortunately. Sport, in fact, reflects society. And so when you're looking at football, you're seeing a reflection of the kinds of violence that might occur or can occur in our society in a sort of box form. When we see cheating on the tennis court, we're really seeing a part of society. And so while sport has been said for centuries, or at least for the last two centuries in our country, to build character, the question becomes what kind of character are we really building in the process? And so sport becomes terribly significant, I think, to the whole process. And that rather than Jacob's ladder concept, what we need to be thinking about is the Sarah Circle, which really deals with working cooperatively in a compassionate way, even as we are competitive. And this is true in general society, as well as we're working in the whole sports world. And that therefore, I have put a hierarchy of the values possible within sport through play as the most universal and probably most underused of all kinds of physical activity that we do. The second one, games, in a sense of childhood games and what we call the new kinds of games which are possible, which are competitive but also cooperative, moving into sports. And in sports, I now see a smaller group of people than the whole group of the play people. And it's not that the sport people may not be competitive, but it is their attitude that we're trying to deal with in the sports world. An attitude of sport that it is still fun, that it is enjoyment, and yet that it is a challenge. I am not for taking the challenge out of sport. If you see me on the volleyball court, you will know that for sure. That I believe in high-level sport, high-level of achievement, and what really moves into athletics. Sports really, as I see it, according to Michener's two, Sport in America, is for everybody. Athletics is not for everybody. The problem is, every father in this country, and soon to be every mother in this country, wants both boys and girls to be in athletics. And that is not an essential part of life at all, that one participates in athletics. I do see sports, games, and play as essential. But athletics moves up the pyramid until it becomes more highly competitive, it becomes more highly organized, more controlled, more chance for failure than in any other one area of probably the school world is in athletics. Intramurals, if you are familiar with the school system, intramurals is still athletics, but in the mildest form and much nearer to sport. Athletics on a high school girls basketball team is moving into the entertainment world more closely than it is into the sports world. And so it really begins to be the community and individual parents' responsibility for whether sport is going to be good or sport isn't going to be good, whether athletics becomes a meaningful educational experience or it is not. And the burden really lies with you as parents, grandparents, and, of course, the teachers. And there's nothing worse than what physical education teachers have done to your kids, including me, in the process of the educational system. I think as we're moving forward in education, however, that the ex-football player who becomes a physical educator is in the minority, partly because the football player doesn't have time to deal with academics, and physical education is dealing much more with what does it mean to be in sport, what is fitness for, what is health all about, and how can we really help create a spirit of fun. And those are not the die-hard football players or basketball players who really want to be in the pros. And then after athletics, you notice I put pros and entertainment. Some take athletics and divide it amateur and pro. But those are the concepts that I'm trying to deal with just in the beginning as we're looking. But included in this are two other important areas, I think. One is Title IX. Anybody messed with Title IX? I know somebody has. You want to tell the world what it is? So it deals in the whole world of physical education and athletics. Anybody in vocation education or home ec? Any of these? Does it have any meaning for that? Or anybody trying to get your girl admitted to Harvard, Dartmouth, the primarily male school, or into a high school that has been boys only or girls only in the past? All of that deals with Title IX. What the newspaper talks about is, again, a realization of the importance of sport in our society. The Act had nothing to do, the makers of it thought, with sport and physical education originally. It was really tailed in, as many things are. Actually, the Act went in with the Busing Act, which said that there must be busing. So it really had to do with racial as well as sexual equality in the whole issue. It's called a Title IX of the Education Amendment Act. It is and would be completely unnecessary, for example, with the ERA. But it is an act that deals only in education. But it deals with admission. It deals with employment. It deals with home ec. It deals with that you may not have shop separately. You may not have any course separately within a school system, that it all must be equal. And that's a very, very significant kind of move. And why it's important in physical education and athletics is because of the stereotyping and socialization process that has happened to your boys and has happened to your girls. And it has a great deal of meaning to the lives of your children. Because your children have had their lives inhibited by virtue of being male or by virtue of being female. Let's take a right after birth. What are some of the sayings, some of the things that happen? You've just had a little boy. What happens in the celebration? What happens in the comments? What happens in how you deal with this? Andy, our four-week-old, how is Andy thought of differently than if we had a Mary Jane 4 weeks old in the village? I think that's our youngest. What are some things?
When my son was
okay? He is immediately patterned into, he's got to be in sports, number one. Number two is he won't be a boy if he doesn't want to be in sports. What else happens? How do you talk? How do you handle a little boy? Tough. And what if you didn't know if it was a little boy or a little girl? Does that bother you? Or has it bothered most people along the way? I went to a toy store when my godchild was 3 years old. No, four. And I said, my godchild is 4 years old. I want a toy that will be enjoyable. First question. Well, is it a boy or a girl? I said, I want a toy. And I repeated it. And the woman absolutely couldn't deal with me and got somebody else in the toy shop to begin to deal. And so immediately we have stereotyped what my godchild can do. And so we went on and on. And finally I found what I wanted for myself in terms of, it was kind of a puzzle with, after you got the puzzle you could build with it. And then underneath it, it had sort of a soft, a fuzzy. And so it really fit, as I thought, exactly. I really preferred or had thought about buying him a doll, but his father would have had a living fit. So I tried to find something that was sort of in between. And so from the very beginning, if your boy 20 years ago wanted to learn to handle babies, it was not through doll practice. It was not through any of the normal ways girls have of learning to handle babies. And in fact, what's that? Doc Spock, the baby man. Spock. Spock talks to fathers in his book by, you hold the baby like, guess what? A football. And so the whole concept in the world separates our two worlds. And sport is the very worst at ways of separating. Because immediately that bouncing baby boy and that cute, delicate girl is separated. And you not only know by the pink booty, but according to the study, you know by the way the father deals with the child. And we don't have this as all bad, except as the boy wants, in fact, to take modern dance. The girl wants, in fact, what's the worst I can think of? Wrestler. She wants to be a wrestler. How do you like that? Does that really blow your mind, she wants to be a wrestler? What's wrong with her being a wrestler? Not a pro wrestler, now. I mean, you know, she just wants to be a wrestler. Wrestling with other little boys when she's little and wrestling with girls when she's older. And why I say that? It's because of the physical differences that will begin to creep in at 11 or 12, in which if I weigh 145, which I do unfortunately, and he weighs 145, and I'm average and he is average, he's going to beat me in a wrestling match. Why are you going to beat me? His body strength based on the hormones that's been secreted from his body all along. And that's the big reason in athletics, for example, for girls, we're separating boys and girls in participation in body contact sports on the upper levels of skill. On the lower levels, and the physical educator and I have been arguing about this for 2 days, on whether we can have co-ed successfully because of the size differences. And my argument is that the boys are more different at the two extremes than the girls are, and that there's a whole middle group that are average. And the average girl and the low-skilled boy fit in the same category. The high-skilled girl and the average boy fit in the same. And there will be some at the top that simply will be all boys playing in a game, and perhaps all girls. But once we get over the concept of rough, tough, bouncing baby boy and delicate, sweet, nice girl, then we can begin, not just in sport, and that's the whole more significant part as I see it in not only talking about sport, but in life, that we understand what stereotyping has done to boys and to girls in growing up, and therefore the consequences of what you are capable of doing and what you are not capable of doing right now. It's all really based on what has happened. And the problem of it is not only human dignity, self-esteem, but the weight that we have had in our society, even in careers, for example, because we haven't permitted that inner mingling. Besides the intermingling being terribly significant to a well-rounded human being in our society. So, for example, what else goes with rough and tough boy if we're going to think of masculine? Absolutely doesn't cry. What is the very best way and word for putting down any boy 16 lower or up? Crybaby, and then chicken, sissy. Sissy is probably even better than crybaby, because that goes beyond it, you're crying. You might possibly be hurt bad enough that that'll let you cry. But a sissy, what's involved in being a sissy? Afraid. Wants to come out of the game, doesn't want to play the game.
Are you saying over half the parents raise their children like this?
I'm saying, yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
Well, I don't agree with you at all.
Well, I hope not. I hope you are absolutely right. And you see, you don't raise them that way purposefully. Particularly the crying is better. And any parent of the very little children, I think a lot of those are doing better. But I've talked to about 45 preschool teachers. And they are convinced that parents are, in fact, particularly they're raising the boy. The girl is getting a lot more freedom than the boy is. And that gets to be even more difficult if even in our Christian society, we're going to end up with a Sarah circle. We can't have a Sarah circle the way we're raising boys because of the competitive concept.
You talked about crime and culture and thought out that and they studied that at Stanford and Berkeley. They said that a man is not supposed to cry and is also always supposed to, you know, suppress his emotions. This is causing stress on the heart. This is causing him to die at the age of 40 and 45 because they're not allowed to let themselves go and to show their feelings.
That's right. And don't many people know that?
Yeah, but you'd be surprised.
Yeah, but maybe you'd be surprised.
I hope so.
You know, I've known that for years and years that it's good to cry. Now, that's nothing new.
Oh, no, none of it is.
And see, what they're saying is that this is one of the, this man was saying, that one of the contributing factors to heart disease and stress and things like ulcers is always, you're never supposed to register. Like they say, you never, like in teaching, you never let your emotions go. You always got to be upper lip and stiff, and you can't show your feelings.
In the Christian community, haven't ministers told people that for years and years?
Oh, but right. You're dealing, like the state I live in, 80% of the people in California are unchurched.
Yeah.
You live in a state that I live in, very few people go to church.
That's
and it's a very secular world. Mentioned the word God, that's out of left field without a glove for a lot of people.
Got any elementary or preschool teachers that can give us some testimony here?
I'm a 15-year-old, and from the 15-year-old mother who talks to the 2-year-old that, you know, don't cry, be brave, be tough, to that 18-year-old adolescent who can't cry, you learn to get the same disease, you know, because of what I said, it goes the whole way. I think too that maybe people are told that, but the message that they're given then goes against that, counteracts that. The body language, just the subliminal message that's given, even though they're saying one thing, a lot of times the underlying message is something totally different.
True. Yeah, I mean there's a lack of awareness.
I think awareness programming really going to be the answer in terms of the freedom. But the problem is our society has programmed so that, what are some other terms that obviously mean it is a male in his personality traits or his social responsibility? That you know for sure we're talking about a male, at least have been.
Pushy,
right. I've got a whole list of about 20 administration kinds of terms like that. She is picky, he is thorough.
Noisy and quiet.
Noisy and quiet. And there are some very interesting studies coming out of Stanford on how girls interact in school with their teacher. And the problem with 85% of our elementary teachers are female. And so the whole role model of why the boys are doing poorly academically does not have so much to do with inability to grow up, nor that his eyes are different, which they may be, slightly in the farsightedness of the child, but rather in how the boy already has learned to react to the female figure who is a submissive kind of figure. And that it begins to mean that teachers, and we did some teacher behavior studies last year, and that teachers are as stereotyped as anybody in how they deal with the girls. If the girls are rowdy, that is absolutely inexcusable. If the boys are rowdy, they're being boys. The best way the girl has of succeeding is by being acceptable and reinforcing the nicety of it. While the male can not have to toe the line in terms of what is happening. And so our whole educational system, not just parents, have been in the process of forcing the concept of this is male and this is female. And it therefore affects the whole sports world almost more than anything else. If we could clean up the sports world, clean up the church, those two together, the religion of sport and the religion of true religion, if we could deal with those two right here in River City, then I think that we would be well on the way to human beings and to the human dignity and the freedom for sort of both extremes. What other words do we have for our males? Aggressive. They have a right, and they ought to be aggressive. What's the nearest new term that a woman can be? Assertive. Now, what I would really like is to take assertive for the female and change aggression of the male to assertiveness. Because assertiveness really is a better way of dealing in terms of our entire society. The men on the volleyball court absolutely cannot believe me. I am purposely not assertive, but aggressive. Openly aggressive on the volleyball court, and they look at me and say, how can she do that? Which lets me look at a very large 6'4" and say, how can you do that to that little girl when you mash her because you want the ball instead of letting her have it? It's the same sort of principle. And the girls have always and ever, and that's why she's right in part of her argument, have always stepped aside. And we know in athletics, what are the girls in the past? Cheerleader, and the boy is the quarterback. Look through all your high school annuals, and all girls, with the exception of a small boy. And that's where we get our whole difficulty of the Napoleon concept. Comes out of what we have done to boys and girls starting from the cradle on up, which affects religion, it affects sport. Why do we have so many women in the church as opposed to men? What are women supposed to be? Getting our terms of what men have been, what are women supposed to be?
Pious.
What?
Stay home.
While they're at home, they are being
mothers.
And what's so in the whole looking at them, what kinds of people are they if they're mothers? What's synonymous with being a mother?
Understanding.
Weak, caring, nurturing, all of the terms that we also would apply in this day and age to Jesus.
Hey, now, is that wrong for them to stay home and be mothers?
Not at all, but it isn't wrong for you to stay home and be a mother too, is the point.
It's pretty hard for me to nurse a child.
That's right, and that's the thing that you can't do, period. Right. That is the only thing.
Well, that's enough.
That's enough for the first 4 months.
It's not really, because there are breast pumps that allow women to remove the milk from their breasts and allow someone else to feed that baby up the milk that comes from that mother, so that the baby is still getting the breast milk.
There's more to nursing than just getting the milk.
Well, that's true, but that's the whole principle of the father being a part of the mothering in the word of nurturing of the child.
Holding.
Yeah, all of that is the responsibility of both, is what I'm saying. There is absolutely, and that's where the women's liberation movement has been wrong in the 60s and the early 70s, was carrying on, as I see it, about mothers staying home or not staying home. The point was the freedom to or not to. Now there is no freedom in terms of the cost of living. I mean, there's an awful lot of mothers that don't want to be at work, that within the way we live in our society, there isn't a choice. And so they would rather be at home. So, and the question is not so much whether they are at home or they aren't at home, but that they have a choice after, say, the nursing stage, the first 6 months. That then there is, all of these things are not wrong. To be tough in lots of ways is not wrong. You're not going to be in athletics unless you can have a tough, individualistic, rugged kind of human being. But if it's good for one, the whole thing is, if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. If it's good for the gander, it's good for the goose. If it's good for human beings, it's good for human beings. The only absolute we really have in our society is reproduction. Everything else is what you would call androgyny or androgynous, or can be. That is, there is no natural competitive instinct for males and non-competitive instincts for females. If you don't believe it, even in our society, take two women who want the same man for a husband. And you begin to see that it is done in sometimes an underlying way. But the reality of it is that it is not an instinct, but rather it is learned. And so the same is true of nurturing is a terribly significant, caring is terribly significant. But those are terms we've given to females. And that's why females are out in left field in sport, and males are out in left field in raising children. And what I'm asking for is a coming together of the very best. And that's what androgyny really is sex-free characteristics. In the sense that I can take on bravery, courage, leadership. You can take on fellowship, nurturing, caring, being the spiritual leader of your family. The women over history have been given the spiritual, mythical responsibility for the piety and for the values in the family. That's why we have double standards, where the male could do this and the female must do this. And the female must do this because she was responsible, really, for the value system in the family. What we're really learning in America is that the male sets the value system in our society, for either the male or the female in their family. And if they have double standards, their children will have double standards, which really gives a scary concept of role modeling, by the way, in the society. So, no, I'm not saying that they ought not to. I'm saying that everybody ought to have that. And so, therefore, the whole issue of a father having the children, we still get a tinge if the father has the child. At our school, we have a gymnast, a gentleman who has his two sons. And I am happy as a lark that he does. His wife is a ne'er-do-well and doesn't really care about anybody but me. And with that eye orientation, me first, there's no way he's going to raise those boys as they ought to be raised. And he is the most loving mother. He really loves the kids. He's training them. He's dealing with them. he lends them out to us, so I can take them to the circus, so I have an excuse to go to the circus. And so there are other influences on the line. But it's terribly significant that he has the boys as opposed to the mother. That mothering is not as sacred, but it's a learned thing. We can tell this, I suppose, by teenage mothers, that it is not a natural thing that only mothers may love, but rather the fathers who have an opportunity, and it's up to the fathers to get the opportunity and for raising the children in the whole process of raising. Any other words that come out as distinctly one or the other in the whole process of male-female? That you can think of it really seems to be distinctly one or the other in responsibility. I suppose one of the things we have is domestic. That's probably the one that we've dealt with the best. And the women have won that round, no question in my mind, because my brother does everything in the house, and my sister-in-law does nothing outside the house. And I think that he's getting the short stick. But that has happened probably more than the opposite. And maybe it's because the women have done the dealing. But in the whole sports world, what all of this means is that at the turn of the century, Theodore Roosevelt is probably the best or worst culprit that we have for what's happened in sports. Theodore Roosevelt, when I say Theodore Roosevelt, what do you think of in his personality traits? Bully. What else about him? Rough. The Rough Riders. Rough Riders. A rugged individualist. He had a very henpecked life, which led him to the realization that if we are going to have men in our society, how can we make them men? There are no wars occurring at the turn of the century. The Spanish one didn't last long enough. The First World War hasn't started. How can we make men? How can we make boys into men at the turn of the century? Sports, the number one way. The right to passage in manhood is through sports. And that's the biggest handicap to the equalization of sport and the freedom for boys, too, in sports. And what ought that sport to be at the turn of the century if you are a Harvard and Yale graduate? Football, obviously football. In 1905, Theodore Roosevelt calls a meeting and says, look, we've got to do something about this football. 18 college players were killed that very year in football. In what was 1904-5. So he calls a meeting. All the time in his head, according to his memoirs, going to keep football. But he calls the meeting to say, we must stop football in this country because we are killing our youth enlist. And it was the enlist that was the important aspect for sport. Enlist. We figure out a way of preventing death. And so the meeting gathered with about 65 men, and what they came up with was the forward pass, for one thing, as the major thing, and so that there was a line of scrimmage, so you couldn't have 11 people on 11 people. And his whole background reading says we must keep football because the elite of our society are getting weak. And the only way that we're going to have a safety valve in our society to keep men is through sports. And ever after, in your concept of why do you want the kids in a team sport, why do you want them in football, ice hockey, fortunately, most not in boxing, is because that's what makes a man. Obviously, football makes a man better than badminton. How many of you have really encouraged your kid to be a great badminton player? Or your neighbors have, you don't have to deal with yourself. Not a one. Badminton is probably the fastest sport that you can give to a child. It may be learned from the age of 9 through 12 by every 9 through 12 child except one who has a severe handicap or visual difficulty. It's tough if you have visual difficulty because the bird moves so fast. But I can guarantee you that you can teach every other child from 9 through 12 how to play badminton. And it's a sport that they can play the rest of their lives. They can play it pitter-pat or they can really play. Have you ever saw Jim Poole, who is the men's national 45 and older badminton player? You see that it's a real sport. In that, it uses more cardiovascular kind of efficiency. Volleyball out here is a far more vigorous sport in terms of calories burned in a good kind of volleyball game for 1.5 hours as some of the track events and playing a half of football, unless you have to be a running back. Yeah. And baseball. Baseball is really a very slow sport. But Theodore Roosevelt kept baseball too, by the way, you'll be happy to know, because it was thriving. But the colleges said, goodbye baseball, because that's the common man's sport. And that's what it became. And the tragedy of this very day for millions of Americans is what? This very day, their concern, their major concern for this weekend. Is there or is there not going to be baseball? And that's because we have taught a generation of values throughout a lifetime. And that's one of the problems of dealing with abundant living. Not that I am against, actually. I watch football, unfortunately. And I think I watch it because I think I love violence because I wasn't allowed. Which is a terrible commentary on what my life is about, perhaps. I also like to watch boxing occasionally until the blood comes.
You know, just because we go watch Little League baseball, that's no sign we're not out a little later playing pro big softball.
Oh, right. But many of them are not.
But many of us are, and there are many more fields being built, and
right.
There's many more participating in it. And another sport is volleyball. There's
right.
The gyms are open far more now than they were 10 or 15 years
ago. Oh, right. But I'm not only concerned about that you're not playing, watching Little League, but what is happening to your son or daughter in you watching Little League. For 60, 70% of you, it's going to do absolutely no harm. And in fact, encourages the parent-child relationship. But for that other 30%, or watching what some of the coaches are doing in terms of screaming at the time. In this book, Every Kid Can Win, there's interviews of the 9 to 12-year-old kids without the parents knowing what it's all about. And we have a huge dropout of boys, and now we probably will with girls, because of the stress that is placed on them in the Little League. I'm also not against watching a good football game, but what I want is if you only have 2 hours, that you carefully decide that it's the football game that you really need to relax more than you need to move. And that is true. Sometimes, as you learned in the stress, it really is more important that you have the ability to relax and watch the ball game than to go participate just because you're supposed to participate. That's the worst kind of participation in terms of stress. Is I've got to jog today because I've got to jog today. That gives just about as much
But it's just as important that we're there watching and play that Little League game as we go watching in a spelling bee or putting some play on in school or sing some song in school or playing the band in school. It's just as important that we're there watching.
If you're there watching them because they've asked you to be there to watch them and you are enjoying it happening. Sport is not, and was not, and play was not, developed for the purpose of spectators. It becomes something else when it becomes an entertainment. And so the care has to be taken on that the child wants you there to watch, and that it becomes a play. It then is an entertainment and a play, and they want you to watch their play, their performance. That is a perfectly legitimate kind of happening. But when the parent becomes more important than the happening, the fun of the sport is what it's all about for kids. If I want to tear my hair out on a volleyball court and get stressed instead of enjoyment, that's my adult problem. But for the kid, if he or she is missing half of the baseballs that are coming to them, and there's a whole group of spectators, think of what that is doing. I'm almost for soccer because of that. Because only the goalie is noticed in soccer. You can be absolutely incredibly poor. You're getting tons of exercise by playing soccer. And the goalie who will select to be a goalie will, in fact, have a better ego and therefore not be harmed. It's the harm that we're doing to our 7 and older kids. And us, the physical educators, have really done it. We really ignored kids if they weren't any good. And that's not how they get better. And they drop out of life in the area of sport. And that's the whole abundant living problem that I really am trying to deal with.
Home, my nephew played in a tennis tournament. He came home
quite happy, so I was sure he had one. But the first thing I say is, did you win? He said, no, I didn't win, but I played the best I ever played against this guy. And that's what sport really is all about, is that you are testing yourself against yourself, and that you can be satisfied with having played your best. Kids know this, but we take it out of kids by insisting upon winning and losing. If you watch a Sandlot softball game, how do they choose a side? Even or uneven, as they've chosen. I mean, do they try to equalize the teams, or do they try, does one kid try to have all the best? One kid will try to have all the best at first. Then he wins 50 to nothing. Then what begins to happen on just a neighborhood Sandlot team?
And then if they choose a side, one guy gets a chance to pick them, and then the other guy gets a chance to pick
them. What we're saying is, what he's saying, though, is that what they really would like is to have all the best. But the reality is they would not, because they do choose to do it your way.
It's a very, and I've learned this in my life, because I was never that athlete, until I came in myself. But I can remember Dennis for not being picked because I was weak and slow and blind, you know, because I couldn't see because, you know, I didn't have glasses yet. And I can, that was really, you know my name. I was the last person picked. No, that's
right, okay, but you were the last one picked in the sports field, but then in other fields, you were the first one picked.
But it shows in the sports field. That's the whole issue, is that it shows in the sports field in a lot of ways, and that's number one to a huge segment of our population. I cannot spell worth anything. Even my teachers didn't know it until I was in high school, because I could memorize 10 words. And unless I tell it, the whole world doesn't know that I can't spell. But if I had selected that I want to play a sport, and I'm sitting on the bench forever, the whole world has a picture of it. And it's that picture that the whole world gets that gets to be a difficulty.
With the Title IX or the ERA, don't you think the extremeness is evident here too? Okay, boys do this, girls do this from the past. Now suddenly we change it totally. The pendulum has swung completely, and it's hard for people to adjust to this. Gradually, the pendulum will swing back a little bit, and then we will be able to accept things better, and so will the kids that are in school. But now, the kids in school, I still feel these 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, I think it's good that boys and girls can sew, that boys and girls can cut wood together, that boys and girls can work on craft together, that boys and girls can play together, but I still feel that in co-ed, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade games. Okay, if you have the best playing together and the poorest playing together, and this little boy who has 2 club feet and can't see is put on the girl's team, isn't he going to feel more badly because he has to play with the girl than if he were in a boys' class where he would be on one of the boys' teams?
The kids say not. Once they have had the exposure, that they adjust to boys and girls, partly because they like to win, but partly because they have been in the setting. Now, your setting is different where they've even been separated 4 through 6. That is probably the worst situation. Those that have had 1 through 6 together, and then or 1 through 5, and then you put 6, 7, and 8, it calls for a different attitude and a different type of teaching. But the value I see of Title IX is exactly that. The boys have been extreme here, the girls have been extreme here. And historically, we're right at the right moment to be talking about this, because we could come to a middle ground in sport and in everything, but particularly in sport, where you take the girl attitude of the past and the boy attitude of the past, you mingle them, and you've got a compromise. It really does come out, in many ways, this new game book. Now, unfortunately, what Title IX also did is to make girls a model of boys. And so they're acting out the same win syndrome that boys have done. But in your social life and in your teaching of the children now, I think there's much more chance of doing anything you want. And that's one of the values of it. And for a while, just in the various sports, you may have the difficulty of the boy, and you may have to move a boy to a middle group, which is half and half. And sacrifice his learning for his psychological being. But what we have found in swimming, for example, with kids, that they really like, that they don't pay as much attention to boys and girls, particularly if you're not actually playing the game for scoring. That gets to be one of the problems. So if we had more new type games and learning skills, and we really taught skill,
then you have sports, like basketball, soccer, and things.
Particularly basketball is difficult. But actually, your tallest person is going to be a girl in the whole thing. But that's why I think this is an opportune time. It's because we've had the girl stereotypes and the boy stereotypes, and if we could just take the best from both and begin to expand the sports that you offer your children so that particularly the 9 through 12 age group, we really give them a variety of skills, then we begin to have more chance for the boys to choose modern dance, for the athletes to come out. And I am not at all against interscholastic as long as you have good coaching. Educational coaching. On the intercollegiate level, I'm absolutely against Division I because that is not an educational experience. That's pro sport. And I don't mind pro sports if you say, this is pro sport, I want to watch, I want to be a spectator. But my plea for you with your children is be careful what sports you're letting your kids watch on television in terms of cheating, violence, and the winning syndrome. That they understand that this is entertainment, this is not how they ought to be acting it out. And unfortunately, our role models are causing a lot of difficulty for our kids, because our athletic role models are not necessarily good role models, and care needs to be taken in trying to deal with that. Finally then, what are all the activities you could be giving to your 9 through 12 year olds or kids all the way, both male and female? What are all the activities they could be doing? Yeah, sport, physical activity.
Soccer,
swimming,
more individual.
Like.
Track and field,
golf,
skiing,
cycling, tennis,
racquetball, swimming,
badminton,
ping pong,
bowling,
pickleball.
Yeah. We're going to need that explained to us.
Frisbee.
Horseshoe, hiking, fishing, climbing, camping. All of these things are things that your children ought to be learning. Just walking about. Jogging is a good kind, or running kind of experience. It's really the whole track and field, all the fundamentals. But then the team sports are a very positive, cooperative possibility. As long as you are playing team sports as a group. And that's why I like volleyball right here, is that what people learn here, unfortunately, and I lead to it, is some very poor players don't learn anything in terms of really fun and enjoyment. But about 85% are learning that you don't have to depend on yourself, that sport is a trusting circle. And out here, you rarely care who wins. In fact, yesterday we had switching of teams back and forth about four times, trying to equal them up in terms of we want a good game. We want it to be even, not we want it to be uneven. And kids will do that too. We just leave them alone on the floor. I'm not so concerned about choosing. Kids are rough on each other, but they also are helpful to each other in the learning. I'd rather have kids arguing out, making whether they're safe or they're not safe, than an official there would take all the responsibility away from the kids. And it really needs to be in the activity. So all I'm really pleading for is, one, that the girls do have an opportunity, and that it starts with the very young child, and that everybody thinks of sport as merely play and enjoyment. It is a game. It is not something that makes the man, and therefore makes the female, masculine. But rather that it is a way of life, an abundant kind of way where you learn trust, you learn faith in one another, you learn to adjust to the abilities of people around you, you become concerned about them, But most of all, you have the fun and physical activity. And so all I would ask is that as you go home, you think of all the things you could be helping your children learn.